Hey, sit down listeners. You can find us every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Save big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a crime history podcast presented by Barstool Sports. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a crime history podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Nadeau, and as always, we are presented by Barstool Sports. As always, make sure you go give us a follow on Twitter at Sit Down Crime Pod. Check us out on YouTube as well, just by searching The Sit Down, a crime history podcast. We are back with another great episode, and you know what we do here. We never go into full-length intros. We just get right in to the subject at hand. And over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks, we have been entrenched with the mafia. Today, we go a little bit different way and do an interview with, really, I got to say, this is one of my favorite pieces of content I've ever done. We've dipped our toes a bit into the world of drug cartels, and today we're going to dip them in a little bit more. I have an individual that for nearly 20 years was a member of the DEA. He was not only an agent, but subsequently would become a supervisory agent in Monterrey, Mexico, running an entire office. We're going to speak to Leonardo Leo Silva, and Leo and I had a terrific conversation really about the beginning of his life, what ultimately got him into wanting to be a DEA agent, what his family thought of his decision, and, you know, really getting into the crux of his career, the arrests that he made. We talked about one story, which is incredible, I have to tell you, in which he arrested a huge person in the Gulf cartel. We talked about not only the Gulf cartel, but we talked about the rise of really the most transcendent drug organization in the history of Mexico, Los Zetas. We talked about their brutal reign of terror, their depraved behavior, and ultimately the thousands of murders that they committed under multiple leaders. It was really a incredible interview, and I hope to have Leo back soon down the road. He's currently writing a book as a retired agent, and I think you guys are going to enjoy the episode. It was filled with a ton of stories and just a fascinating person. So here you go, my interview with Leo Silva. As I said, next week, before I get into this, I've been talking about it for a while. And before we get to the interview, I want to tell you guys about it. I have a huge person coming on next week. We'll get back to the mafia. And I'll tell you guys, this really is a testament of how far this show has come. And I really look forward to you guys hearing about it. I'll kind of release some information on Friday this week of who's coming on. And I hope you give it a shot. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. I worked tirelessly to get it. It was really through my own hard work. So I urge you to look forward to it. Something you can be excited about. A little bit of a tease for you. And I hope you enjoy it. But here's our episode 80. Happy Halloween, by the way. We're recording this on Monday the 31st. Here's my interview with retired DEA agent Leo Silva. I hope you enjoy it. All right, joining the sit down now, I got to say, I'm super excited for this guest. I've come across several individuals recently that worked in the DEA, worked for Homeland Security. And today's guest really was one of the more top echelon people in the DEA, really at the border for years. We're going to speak to a guy called Leonardo Silva. Mr. Silva, you have one of the more fascinating stories, and I've wanted, when we kind of broaden the show, to not talk about just mafia members and things of that nature. I really wanted to get into cartel content, and I did a show on El Chapo, but I think one of the more interesting groups really in the history of drug cartels are not only the Gulf cartel, but ultimately Los Zetas. And You know, when I found you, I felt like you were the perfect person to have come on and talk about that group. And really, you were the supervisor of the office out of Monterrey, which is in Tamaulipas. I want to welcome you to the show. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I think, you know, you, like I said, present a really unique look into the world of cartels. And I think, you know, most lay people, when they talk about crime, you know, they've heard of drug cartels. But, you know, I've said before, I think they're the most violent people on the face of the planet, quite frankly. And they've completely transformed Mexico into a hellscape, quite frankly. Drugs are coming over really for years now. And, you know, that's really besides the point. It's keeping the territory and what goes into keeping territory, as you know. And what I find interesting about where you were in Tamaulipas is, you know, they have a 200, you know, when you look at Tamaulipas, they have a 230-mile border stretch with Texas. There are border points, which, as you know, Nuevo Laredo and all these different spots, really in your neck of the woods. So I kind of want to start at the beginning, kind of how you got into law enforcement. You know, you actually were raised in South Texas, right, as far as I know?
Yeah, that's correct. I was born in Brownsville, Texas, and went to school there, high school and my college. And you know, I'm pretty much a Texas border rat, man.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I heard you at one point, you were going to school to be a teacher, like some sort of school teacher, from what you said. And then, you know, through several people that you knew, you decided to just one day go into the DEA. And I'm fascinated because I interviewed a guy that was with the FBI. He was undercover in the mafia and other things. And he kind of had a similar kind of thought. He had kind of always wanted to be a cop. Did you always want to be in law enforcement? And why the sudden urge to be a DEA agent? And what really at that point went into being a DEA agent? Because now it seems like you have to take on becoming a cop and then, you know, take all these different things. Why the sudden urge to go into law enforcement? Is that something you always want to do?
Well, I was always intrigued with law enforcement, you know, and, you know, as a kid growing up, you know, I worked when I was 14, 15 years old, I worked in a restaurant with my dad. My dad was a manager, and it was a pretty upscale restaurant down there in Brownsville. It's the only one pretty much. And we had people come from all over to the restaurant for dinner at night. And obviously, you know, we're in Brownsville, Texas. We're right on the border with Matamoros. And so all the drug kingpins from Matamoros at the time would come to dine at the restaurant. And I would see these guys come in, you know, I mean, they spend lots of money. You know, here I'm 14, 15, I'm seeing these guys drop thousands of dollars on, you know, expensive champagne bottles and stuff like that and big dinners. And then, you know, what really fascinated me one time is the head waiter. You know, he's like the master waiter. He comes to me and he says, "Listen, I need you to go tell that group of people to move from that table." You know, so people about, you know, 6-7 people. And I'm like, man, why do I have to do it, man? I'm 14 years old. He's just go do it. You won't regret it. So I went over there, you know, the best I could. And I said, hey, not for nothing, but, you know, you guys are going to have to leave and sit at another table, apologize for the inconvenience, you know, so they didn't want to, but, you know, I said, those people had already reserved this table. When they look and see who they are, they're like, oh, okay, no problem, right? And it turns out it was, you know, part of the Juan Garcia Abrevo people. You know, it wasn't Juan Garcia himself, but it was his people. Wow. And I'm like, I told my dad that night, I said, who are these guys, man?
Yeah, you were fascinated.
Who the hell are these guys? And this, oh, just don't even ask, son. You know, those are mafia type guys. Don't even ask, you know, just do what you're told.
Right.
Serve them what they want. You know, at the end of the night, I got a pretty decent tip. You know, they gave the waiter a good, decent tip, and I was his assistant. So, and it was then that
I'm sure it was difficult for you because, you know, I talk about this time and time again, really in any ethnic enclave, whether it's an Italian enclave or a Mexican enclave. You know, I think, you know, your parents do the best they can to shield you from those types of people because, you know, like them, you're Mexican-American or, you know, you're Mexican in general, and your father knows who those people are, and I'm sure he did his best to keep you away from that because, as you know, there's really three ways of life in that world. It's you become a gangster, you become maybe a priest or some blue-collar worker, or you become a cop. And, you know, it's interesting how you were kind of thrown into that and you kind of saw it from the beginning that those probably weren't the people you wanted to be and you took the other route. I did want to ask you, what did your family think about you wanting to be in that world? Because, you know, obviously it's a dangerous business. You're not working in, you know, Iowa somewhere. You're working in a border crossing and several border crossings that are the most dangerous in the world, quite honestly. And, you know, your father and mother know who those folks are. You know, what did they say about your jump and wanting to do that?
Well, my father at first was, he was totally against it. You know, he's like, you know, Leo, you should just stick with your path that you have, you know, become a teacher and just, you know, stay on the conservative side. And my mom was very supportive. She's like, do what you want to do, right? My dad kind of, my dad was afraid for me because he understood the dangers of being, you know, a DEA agent on the border, you know. Sure. And of course, you know, I was very close with my grandparents and they didn't even know what the hell a DEA agent was, man. So they were just like, just whatever makes you happy, right? They just really didn't understand. And when I finally became a DEA agent, my grandfather, I remember him saying, hey, so where's your car with the siren and the lights and all that stuff? And I was like, well, I'm not that kind of
police. I really like that. You know? Well, so, and you came in at a really wild time, quite honestly, a very sad time in the Drug Enforcement Agency. You come in 87, and 2 years previous, we talked about this during the Chapo episode, and this is really one of the sadder times in the war on drugs in Mexico. Kiki Camarena is kidnapped and ultimately executed by, you know, drug dealers. And, you know, you come in 2 years later. What was the DEA like at that time? You know, obviously, you know, it's a little different time. You know, an agent had just been murdered. What was it like? And what were your also initial job tasks? Because, you know, you come in as a young agent, you know, they're not going to throw you, I guess, you know, in a way, they're probably going to throw you into the depths of the beast. But what kind of things were you doing? What was the camaraderie like? And what was the DEA like then when after he was executed?
You know, I came on in 87. Kika's murder was in 85. Even though 2 years had passed, I mean, it was a very dark period, you know, especially for our office here in McAllen, Texas, because not only was Kika killed in 85, but in 86, we had an agent killed here in McAllen. By the name of William Ramos on an undercover deal. So the office, there was some dark times, man. You could feel it. You know, there was a lot of resentment between the Mexican the federal police and DEA at the time. And, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, we were putting a lot of heat on them. So in my office, you could feel the darkness, you know, the dark times that we were going to. And even though we were going through some dark times, we had fun. I mean, the camaraderie was excellent. When I came on the job, my partner, Mario Alvarez, who's one of the best agents ever, especially at undercover, took me under his wing. And right off the bat, man, I mean, on my third day on the job, I was doing undercover deals for, you know, buying heroin, buying small amounts of cocaine, street level, you know, just to get experience as an undercover agent. And it was all under the tutelage of Mario Alvarez, who was at the time considered the best undercover agent in pretty much all of DEA. So I was very lucky to learn from him and go out and do those assignments as a young agent. I was 22 years old, man. And I was, like you say, I was thrown right into the fire, man, you know.
Let me ask you, I you know, obviously, you know what you're getting into. But as I said, you're not working in Middle America or some mountain region. You're working in a very dangerous place. I know no cop or someone in law enforcement, they never want to admit that they were scared, but you're a young kid. I mean, you were scared, right? Like, did you have any fear?
Of course. And that's what protects you. I mean, because you take that extra level of caution. Right. You know, if you're not scared, then man, there's a problem. Because I was nervous in every single deal that I went to, you know, just wondering what if this happens or this happens, and right. your mind is always moving at like 1,000 miles an hour, you know. So
trying to it was a period where, as you alluded to, not only in your office but in close offices, you know, people were passing away, and you know, it's a really interesting time in the drug cartel world because, You know, the topic today is losetas, and as you know, I mean, I found losetas to be the most transcendent drug cartel really ever, because what they were able to do is take cartels into this paramilitary level, right, which we're going to talk about. But when you came in, it was, you know, law enforcement was almost not necessarily off limits, but the Camarena stuff was the first time it had really happened. You know, that was really in the forefront there. And, you know, I guess did you back then, the thought was law enforcement was off limits. It was kind of like, in a way, some of these other groups like the mafia, where you try to have some sort of ethical thought. You know, nowadays it's they don't care. They'll kill anybody. Was there, though, a thought that that kind of were the rules at that point?
It was the understanding, pretty much an unwritten rule, right? When they murdered Camarena, I think Caro Quintero and his folks thought, well, he's just another cop. Just like in Mexico, the cop's life is worth nothing in Mexico. So they figured it's the same thing. But when they got all that heat come down, they understood that, hey, this is why there's these unwritten rules.
You know? Oh, interesting. So you're saying that in a way you didn't think they knew that he was a DEA agent.
They knew that he was an agent, okay. But they just didn't think that there was going to be the reaction from the United States like there was, you know, because in Mexico, cops get killed every day and nobody cares.
Yes.
Nobody, sometimes people don't even show up for their funerals, but here it's a different story, man. And when that happened, you know, well, DEA has a long memory. We never forget. And to this day, you know, Caro Quintero was caught a couple of months ago, and we just never forget, you know.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that at the end. You know, it's 35 years since this happened, basically, more than that. And, you know, we're still, as a country, fighting for Caro Quintero to pay for his behavior. You know, and as you said, he was just arrested. And I'll get to that at the end. But so you come in, you know, late 80s, you know, you kind of becoming an agent, you know, a 3-4 year agent by the early 90s. At that point, the Gulf Cartel is in your area, that border crossing in South Texas, Matamoros, you know, in the Tamaulipas, Nuevo Laredo. Gulf Cartel pretty much controls that area, and they're fighting off other groups. But as we know, that is a very lucrative border crossing area, that 230-mile stretch, because, I mean, in your opinion, Nuevo Laredo is the big, you know, that's the most important border crossing on the border, no?
That's correct. And, you know, the reason the Tamaulipas is so important is because there's several border crossings. You have some in Brownsville, you have some in Westlake, Texas, McAllen, Texas, Laredo, you know, so Del Rio, and you know, it's very important. I mean,
remember, you know, in Tamaulipas, there are huge cities, Reynosa, Ciudad Victoria, all these different spots, it's very fruitful, you know, it's big business there. At the time, Juan Garcia Abregu is in control, this kind of old school guy. You know, and by 1994, it's alleged that the Gulf Cartel is responsible for bringing 1/3 of the cocaine in this country into America. And when we did the Chapo show, we talked about how it almost was like a trampoline, if you will, where Colombia sends it, it bounces off Mexico into America, and all the drugs are going into America. And, you know, this guy, Abregu, becomes a top 10 fugitive. The U.S. wanted him bad. They would ultimately get him by 1996 in Monterrey. Do you have any recollection of that arrest and that kind of whole process? Do you remember that at all?
Well, sure. We used to work very closely with our agents in Monterrey at the time. And we used to interchange intelligence on Garcia Abregu, you know. So, yeah, I remember when he was caught and he was extradited and brought in, flown into Houston. And he was fighting it the whole way, man. He didn't want to go down. But fortunately, they were able to capture him without a shot being fired, you know. He was armed, but he didn't fire. He didn't have time to use his weapon. So, it was a big arrest.
Do you have any recollection of what kind of things does he say to the agents? Do you know at all? Like, what do those folks say? Do they talk at all? Do they have any conversations? I mean, most of them I've noticed are fairly stone-faced. They don't seem to have much to say, but did he talk at all? Do you know of?
Oh, sure. He threatened their families and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's typical, you know, thug behavior, man, you know? So, I mean, yeah, he was a top-notch guy, but he, bottom line, he's still a thug, you know. So but he was a smart plug. I mean, he's the one that started the cocaine industry here in the United States. He made an agreement with the Colombians, and where they agreed that every load that would be brought in by Juan García Oreo to the United States, he would keep 50% of it for himself. And the Colombians said, yeah, we'll agree to that. But you just stay away from the East Coast because that's our market.
Right.
And you can have the rest. Wow. So that's how he started, man.
You know, you hear, and you know, I know you know this, you know, you see on TV, you know, we see these Chapo documentaries and all this different stuff. And look, El Chapo was a huge drug trafficker. I mean, one of the biggest ever. But people like Abrego aren't talked about a ton. And it's amazing the amount of money these individuals are making. I mean, think about what a kilo of cocaine costs. I mean, they're bringing in, you know, tons of loads. 50% is a huge amount of money. Do you guys know, in essence, estimate of wise, how much he was worth at the time? I mean,
well, there's some estimates out there that he was in excess of a couple of billion dollars.
That's incredible wealth to think about. And you think of over the last 25 years, he's serving 11 life terms, which is a good ending for someone like him. And you know, he's going to die in a federal prison in America. But the problem that we have in the Gulf cartel at this point, as you know, is there's a power vacuum. People want that control. They want that mantle. That's a huge mantle. There's a lot of money there. And people jockeyed for power for 2 or 3 years or so. There was a guy that kind of popped up, Salvatore Herrera, El Chavo, as you know. But he's ultimately killed by a guy called Osiel Cardenas, who was his best friend. And he would earn the nickname Matamigo, right?
Which
tell us what Matamigo means. Friend killer, right?
Matamigo means friend killer. I mean, here's the deal with Osiel Cardenas. Osiel Cardenas was a heavy cocaine user. And he was already paranoid to begin with. And once he started using cocaine in excess, I mean, that paranoia just grew to unreal levels. And that's when he decided to hire these retired or ex-military types to protect him from danger, right? From enemies. So he hires Arturo Guzman de Sena, who was called Z1. And Arturo Guzman eventually recruited other guys from the military that were special forces, not just any military guy. These guys were special forces, highly trained guys. Some even trained by U.S. folks, U.S. military. So, you got guys like Jaime Gonzalez Duran, you have Heriberto Lascano, among others. And I think the original was like 20 some Zetas that were special forces. And they were exclusively at Osiel Cardenas' beck and call so that they could protect him and do away with his enemies.
This was an incredibly, as you would agree, this is an incredibly smart tactic because, not only are you fighting the U.S. government, the Mexican government, but you're fighting other cartels to get the level of this person in to protect you. And as you alluded to, this is not like some private in the military. These are like highly trained special ops, right? They have sea, air, ground, urban, rural warfare training. Like they, as you talked about, they're being trained by our best people, right? To fight. And what he basically does is, as you know, is he pretty much just offers them more money than the military is paying them. The military doesn't pay much. He says, I'll just give you more money. Come work for me. And this would create Los Zetas, as you said. He kind of takes full control in the late 90s, 1999. Let me ask you, when you hear about this, obviously this is a new tactic. No one had really done this. Cartels had hitters, but they weren't to the level of this. What was the overall thought in some of those DEA offices? Is this something that, how do you come across this sort of information? What did you ultimately think about it?
Well, wow. At first, we didn't even know who the Zetas were. We knew that Cardenas had a security detail, but it wasn't until the mid-2000s that we started understanding, hey, these guys are ex-military, man. These guys are highly trained. They're trained in explosives, counterinsurgency, guerrilla warfare, stuff like that. This isn't just your regular guy off the street, man. but it wasn't apparent right away. They kept the lid on it pretty well. Our focus at the time was to capture Cárdenas because of the incident he had with a DEA agent and an FBI agent in Matamoros, where he threatened to kill him. So again, you know, here's another guy making a mistake and threatening a U.S. law enforcement officers, you know, a DEA agent and an FBI agent.
Can you, I want you to kind of, and I know that Fuentes, the guy that was involved with that, has told the story. Can you talk a little bit about that story? It's pretty fascinating how, you know, he basically is with an informant with another agent and they're just driving. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it was one of our agents out of Monterey and an FBI agent out of Monterey, and they had an informant, and he had this informant had information on one of Ociel's houses, one of his hideouts. Mm-hmm. In Matamoros. So they made a day trip out of it and went down from Monterrey to Matamoros to check it out with the informant in the backseat. And when they came up on the place, well, guess what? There's Ociel with a bunch of his guys right there. So the informant's information was right on the money. Unfortunately, they saw our guys and they stopped them and surrounded the car with a bunch of armed guys and threatened to kill him. And my colleague at the time, I won't mention his name, but he's a very good friend of mine, talked his way out of it. I mean, he was talking to Ociel. He says, hey, look, you don't want another Camarena incident. You don't want to be the next Cabo Quintero. If you kill us right now, I mean, you're going to kill us, but you know what's going
to
happen.
The weight of the United States is coming down.
Right. He says, so just let us go and, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. And he did let him go. He thought about it and he let him go.
One thing I find interesting about people to the level of Cárdenas is, you know, when we look at other criminal organizations, most notably like the mafia, when you become the boss of a family, you're not dealing hands-on with things like that, right? You're dictating that to other people. Do you find it interesting that these people still at the level of Cárdenas are doing things like that? Do you find that interesting? Because it's interesting to me that, like, I would think he would want to be away from anything that could get him pinched, and he just kind of stays up on the hill and lets everyone else dictate things. Is that normal that they do stuff like that?
Well, you know, like I said before, I mean, Cárdenas was a heavy cocaine user.
True.
So
that's true.
His judgment was impaired at times.
So that's not a norm, you're saying, in a way.
Right. It's not. It really isn't. I mean, you know, these guys delegate things to other guys.
Yeah.
You know, but like I say, you know, Cárdenas was highly addicted to cocaine, and it impaired his judgment.
I think one thing, and one thing I found interesting about the Zetas is they become not just a security unit. They are creating new routes of drug traffic. They're involved with extortion. They're doing things to, you know, not only make money, but to expand territory and just become a more formidable organization. And as you know, with NAFTA, I mean, that made profits just soar in the 90s. And I want to ask you, obviously, as you know, what this also leads to, and you cannot protect territory without hurting people. The Zetas become notorious for the barbaric depravity that they show anybody. And we're talking about beheadings, public beheadings, flayings, hanging people off bridges. The level of brutality, had you seen that before? And if so, or if not so, what do you think about that? That's obviously incredibly depraved behavior.
I've never seen that before, not here in Mexico. I mean, we've heard about stuff like that happening in Italy, sure. You know, with the Cosa Nostra.
Yeah.
But here in Mexico, we've never seen that. Sure, there's executions, there have been executions before. But when these guys came on the scene, they just totally took it to a new level and did things that have never been seen before in Mexico or the United States. And it just kind of caught us off guard, you know, because we just never seen that before. It was incredible. And the guy that drove all that stuff was Miguel Treviño, who eventually became the head of the Zetas.
Yeah, which I'm going to ask you about. I do want to ask you a question. And if you don't want to respond, I understand. Obviously, I would have to imagine you've come up on body parts, heads, that sort of thing. Did you? And if so, what is that like? I mean, I obviously we you see pictures, you think it's like a Halloween thing or something, but What is seeing that like? You know, I'm sure you come up on scenes and stuff, right?
It's mind-boggling, you know, and you just never get used to something like that, you know, no matter how many times you see it. But it gets you to wonder. It's like, what are these guys thinking, man? Do they even have any regard for human life? And obviously they don't. They don't. And Trevino was a master at recruiting people that had no regard for human life.
Right, right. And I think I saw an interview with someone that was in that syndicate, and he talked about how, and I've talked about this on our show, like truly evil people, they don't have soft hearts. They're not compassionate. And he talked about that, like, you don't, it's not about feelings. It's a job, and this is how we do it. And we don't look at, if you have feelings, you shouldn't be in this business. That's kind of how I think it goes. So by the mid-2000s, they become this La Compañía type of thing, where it's this golf cartel with this huge military wing of people. And like I said, they did what they had to do to protect. Now, one of the higher ranking people in the golf cartel at the time was this guy called El Puma, Carlos Landon Martinez, I believe his name is.
Correct.
And this is a high value target for you guys, because he is bouncing back between South Texas and Mexico. And he was, from what I understand, a plaza boss. And when I say plaza boss to anyone that doesn't know, think of it like he runs the city for that wing of the cartel or whatever. Tell us more about Puma. And you had a wild encounter with him. Ultimately, it led to his arrest. Tell us more about him and his arrest.
Well, like you said, you know, he was a plaza boss of Reynosa, which is right across the border from McAllen, Texas, where I was stationed at the time. And at the time, I was in charge of what is called a HIDA task force, High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area Task Force. And it consists of various agencies from our county here, and federal agencies such as IRS, Border Patrol, ICE, you know, FBI, and we had some of the local agencies. You know, we had the sheriff's office and a bunch of police departments that were assigned to our group, and I was a supervisor. And at the time, we had some intelligence information on a guy named Carlos Landin Martinez. They called him El Puma, also El Comandante. And we developed intelligence on him and found out who his lieutenants were and started investigating them and trying to work our way up to the top so we could finally get to Carlos Landin Martinez. And I'm telling you, it was a lot of work, man. For a span of maybe 2 to 3 years, we did numerous telephone wiretaps on his associates and were able to develop enough evidence for an indictment on a lot of his associates. But we did not want to move on the associates until we got him, because if we move on them,
you know,
he's gonna be in the wind. We'll never find him.
Right.
Now, back in 2007, you know, we had intelligence that he was here in South Texas. So we had our, you know, state troopers, the DPS, you know, they have an air wing and we have an air wing. And we set up these very intricate surveillances on locations where we thought he might be found. And we had, you know, eyes in the sky. We had helicopters and planes and everything and ground units looking for this guy. You know, we were never successful, man. I mean, we always came back and said, man, we thought we were going to get him this time, but zero. I mean, this went on for months. And mind you, we had already been investigating him for a couple of years. So one day, you know, it's the weekend. You know, I'm at home and we decide we're going to have a family barbecue. You know, my son was visiting and turn on the pit and everything. And my wife says, hey, you know, I forgot to buy corn at the store. Can you go to the store real quick and buy some corn? And I said, well, yeah, okay. You know, I need to buy some ice anyway for the beer. So, so went to the store, you know, I was even wearing my DEA logo shirt, you know, and everything. And I
stopped. You were just a citizen, basically.
Yeah, I'm just going to go in and out, man. You know, I'm wearing my DEA shirt, but who cares, right? Nobody cares. So I go, I'm going to go in the store, you know, and I'm at the corn section looking at the corn and making sure it's the quality's correct, you know, because the wife will get mad and all that stuff. So I'm loading up the corn and this dude walks by me and we lock eyes, man. I was like, I know this guy. I had a picture of him in my office hanging there for 2 years, man. So he walks right past me and we lock eyes, man. And I said, where do I know this guy from? And I turn around and he's being guided through the store by two guys, kind of like bodyguards, you know, and they're really close to him. They're protecting him. And I said, no, man, it can't be. It just can't be. So what I did is I circled around and went to kind of follow him discreetly through the store, right? And he goes to the watermelon section. And he's looking at a watermelon. He's checking it out and showing it to the boys that they're guarding him. And I guess they agree on the quality. And they start walking out of the store. So I said, man, and I got very close to him and I saw him again. And I said, that's him. This is Carlos Landin Martinez, the guy we've been looking for over 2.5 years, man. Here he is in the store buying a watermelon. So I'm like, shit, you know, I try to be discreet. And he goes and buys his watermelon and I pay for my corn, you know, still trying to be discreet and following him out of the store so I don't lose him. And he goes with his boys and they get into a white pickup truck, I remember. And I'm riding in my wife's Ford Focus, you know, with a Hello Kitty sticker on the back and everything. So I'm like, man, if these guys are armed, man, they're going to make Swiss cheese out of me, man, right here. But I'm going to follow them. Mm-hmm. So I keep following them and I get on the phone and I call one of the guys that's on my task force who's with the McAllen Police Department. And I said, hey, I need you to get some units out here and help me stop this pickup truck because I think Carlos Landin is inside that car, that truck. So he called out to some of his units, and just as luck would have it, I mean, luck was on our side that day. One of the units just happened to be in the area. Wow. And he pulls up alongside me, and I point out the truck, and he goes after it. Well, like I say, luck was on our side. The truck happens to run a red light in front of a McAllen police officer, man. So he lights him up, goes over there and asks for their IDs. And Landin is cool, man. He's like, yeah, sure, here's my ID. And the ID says Carlos Landin Martinez. And it's him. So we said, lock him up, man. You know, put the cuffs on him. And that's what they did. And they got him. And like I say, luck was on our side. And after all these years of looking for him and wiretaps and surveillances and stuff like that, I found him at the HEB grocery store here in McAllen, Texas, buying a watermelon.
It has to be one of the most incredible arrests ever that never, I mean, it was just a regular pickup, you know, you just happen to see the guy. What ultimately happened to him?
He went to trial. I testified in his trial along with a lot of other agents and witnesses, and he received a life sentence.
I would love to see the look on his face when you walk into the room. And I'm sure he looked at you, you know.
Well,
sure
we interviewed him that same day. And
what did he say?
He said nothing. He just told us to pound sand, you know, pretty much.
Pretty old school.
Yeah. So he said nothing. So he knew who I was, you know. So
I know in his trial, they tried to paint him as, you know, grandfather and just this loving guy. And, you know, it's always seemingly the ploy, right? You know, try to get the jury to feel like he's this great dude and whatever, but what a wild, you know, you got to thank your wife for that, right? I mean, that's.
Oh, yeah. Let me finish the story, man. So, okay. So I obviously I got caught up in the arrest and we went to interview him and then she's calling me and said, hey, you're not going to believe this. I mean, we were newlyweds. We had just been married for under a year, you know, so. Mm-hmm. So she goes, where are you? You know, where's the corner? The coals are already, you know, turning into ashes, man. You know, where are you? Where you been? Like, oh, you're not going to believe this. You know, we just caught this big fugitive we've been looking for 2 years. And she actually didn't believe me at first until, you know, I came home and explained to her the story. And, you know, I had to restart the fire. And we ate dinner pretty late that night.
Right. Well, the barbecue didn't go like it was going to go, but hey, I guess you have to understand that's an amazing story. I wanted you to tell that because it's fascinating.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
So Cardenas is eventually arrested, the head of the golf cartel, gets extradited. And as you talked about, the control he would create, it kind of continued until he gets extradited to the United States. Mexican prisons don't, they're not going to look into this guy. They'll let him do what he does. But once he goes to America, there's no more communication with his drug pals. They're not going to be talking on the phone. That's not going to work anymore. This guy, Heriberto Lascano, takes over. He kind of takes it back to what it was. You're dividing territories. And I guess for me, I wanted to ask you, what do you think the rest of the cartel thought about that? You know, there was probably people in the cartel that were a little annoyed with it. And most notably, Cardenas's brother, who I think they didn't bring in because he had his own addiction problems. What did you think about that?
Well, that's when the Zetas started to realize, hey, we can be the top dogs here.
Yeah.
You know, because all the other leaders for the Gulf cartel, just, they didn't have it. You know,
they're inept. I mean, yeah.
There was Tony Tormenta was, like you said, he's a drug addict. And you had El Cos, who was a pretty steady leader, but he just didn't have that killer instinct that Cardenas did, you know.
Yep.
And he didn't have the killer instinct that Lascano and Treviño did. So these guys started realizing, hey, you know, we could probably run this show ourselves.
We don't need the Gulf cartel.
Exactly. And that's what they started to do. So little by little, they started taking power over the Gulf cartel and developing their own customers and their own, you know, distribution networks. And like you said before, they started expanding into other things like extortion and kidnapping and prostitution and all this stuff, you know, especially in Monterrey, when they first came into Monterrey and took over that city, man, they just instilled terror into that city, man, with the extortions and everything. And that's when they started coming into power. And like you say, you don't get into power by being a nice guy. I mean, these guys, when they extorted people and they didn't come through with payments, they were brutal. You know, like you say, you know, throwing bodies over overpasses and stuff like that, and hanging and then just mutilating body, you know, cadavers and stuff like that. So they were brutal, and they sent a message to everybody, not just the other criminals, but to the entire Mexican community. You know, if you don't comply with what we do, you're going to end up in pieces in a trash bag.
Well, you know? And this is something that we would all find out, because by this point, the cartel execution videos are becoming very popular online. You know, they're starting to post this stuff where they want the world to see how truly depraved they are. And, you know, look, I will admit, sadly, that I've seen all these. They're in, you know, again, I wouldn't search them out. They're not going to do anything for you to watch them. But they ruled with the most iron of fists. You know, if you didn't pay that $1,000 they wanted, they have no problem just cutting your head off and throwing you in the street. By this point, you are in Monterrey, right? You're kind of leading the charge, right?
After the Puma arrest, you know, I had applied for the spot in Monterrey as a resident agent in charge, and I was lucky enough to get it, to get selected. So by September of 07, I was already doing a temporary duty assignment to Monterrey and getting my feet wet and familiarizing myself with the work that we had to do over there. And when I first got there, my boss in Mexico City called me up to Mexico City, and he says, I want to talk to you about some things. So went up there, and he pretty much gave him my marching orders. And he said, you see this guy, Miguel Treviño? I want him. He says, I want that to be your primary focus when you're there in Monterrey. And I want you to get him. You know, I want you to focus on this guy. And that was it, man. That's all I needed to hear, you know. So I go back to Monterrey, and we start, you know, developing a strategy as to how we're going to do this. And because these guys at the time, you know, they pretty much took over the whole city, like I said. There was a section in Monterrey called Barrio Antiguo, Old Town, right? And there was a bunch of really nice restaurants and bars and stuff. And just like any old town in any city, you know, really nice. You know, a lot of tourists would go there. And these guys went in and they completely took over that section, extorting businessmen, restaurant owners and stuff. And you pay me $2,000 a month, or else, you know, we're going to burn this place down. Or, you know, worse yet, we're going to kill you or your family. And a lot of guys at first resisted. And they said, no, I'm not going to pay you shit, man. So the next day they'd come back and they say, okay, now it's going to be $3,000 a month. Or else, look at, this is your daughter, right? She goes to this school. You live right here and this and that. If you don't pay us by tomorrow, you know, you're never going to see her again.
Right.
So, I mean, those kind of tactics they started to use, and they just shut down that whole place. And even us at the U.S. consulate down there, they prohibited us from going down there after hours because it was just too dangerous. You know.
So, and I want to, you know, I kind of want to give a background on Trevino Morales. He ultimately takes over when Lascano is killed. Lascano is killed in a gunfight. And, you know, Trevino is a little different than Dazetas because he does not have a military background, right? He's this guy from Nuevo Laredo. He kind of, you know, and I've done some research on him. His father died when he was a kid, and he kind of becomes the man of the house. He gets involved with the local group in there, kind of works his way up. And anyone that I've talked to on this subject, and I'll see if you agree, even if I'm asked, if you ask me who the most barbaric human being I've ever come in contact with, not literally, but read about, Trevino. He seems to be the kind of leader in the clubhouse for that sort of thing. Would you agree with that, that he's probably the most depraved individual you've ever looked into?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I did a tour in Guadalajara from 2002 to 2004. And at the time, I was assigned to work the Arellano Felix organization, me and my partner. And at the time, I thought Ramon Arellano Felix was the most, you know, feared individual on the planet. You know, this guy had killed, I mean, just for looking at him cross-eyed, he'll kill you. And at the time, I figured, yeah, this guy is the baddest man, you know. And once we started investigating Trevino and reading about some of the stuff that he did and interviewing some of the people that actually had interactions with him, I said, Ramon Arellano is in kindergarten compared to this guy, man. You know, yeah. I mean, it's just no comparison. I mean, it's just incredible.
Hey guys, it's Big Cat, and Fight Week is here. Rough and Rowdy 24 invades Clarksburg, West Virginia this Friday night, April 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern for the first time since Rough and Rowdy 1. Every single fight will be a brand new brawler, and we found the wildest hillbillies the holler has to offer. Order now to enjoy 20 amateur matchups with no headgear, plus our live ring girl contest after the final bell. These country roads are being paved with blood and grit and balls. Join me and Dave on the call for Rough and Rowdy 24 tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern. Witness all the chaos with pay-per-view replay available all weekend long on buyrnr.com. That's buyrnr.com.
I heard someone tell the press at one point that was in the organization that Trevino couldn't sleep at night if he didn't kill someone that day. I've heard someone say that. And look, I'm not going to get into the particulars of the things that he was doing, but, you know, putting people in stews, you know what El Guiso is.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's just a very depraved dude. And so you're told at that point, this is target number one. This is the guy we need to, Z40, they called him, right?
Right.
This is the goal, getting him off the street. What was the plan? Did you have, like, I don't know if you could tell us, but like, what do you do? Like, how do you even do that?
Well, yeah, it was something hard to figure out. I mean, but eventually we had a strategy that, okay, it's like playing a golf game. I mean, you know, you're not going to make a hole in one on every hole, on every green. So you got to take it strategically and do it piece by piece. Right. So our strategy was to start with the lower level leaders and take them out and work our way up to him. Just like we had on other investigations, just like we did with Puma and many other targets that we've had. So, but I mean, this is different because this is a huge organization and they're spread out all over the place. And so we'll just focus on our area here in Monterrey. And Monterrey, we're responsible for Nuevo León, San Luis Potosí, and Coahuila. And, you know, we had an office in Matamoros and Nuevo Laredo at the time. So that was a big help. So the strategy was to take them out piece by piece, chip away at the rock, you know, and until we finally dismantled it.
And by this point, they're completely split. The Zetas are the criminal authority on the border at Texas. And, you know, in a way, you start kind of, you know, you as the DEA, you start getting into kind of squabbles with them. At one point, they and Trevino agreed on it. They bombed, they threw some sort of explosive into the consulate. Tell us about that.
All right. Yeah. So I was already there in Monterrey. You know, we're entrenched already. And this was in October of 2008. I'll never forget it. You know, what happened is Trevino's mom had gotten stopped at the border in Nuevo Laredo and was questioned for many, many hours. And he got pissed off. And he knew it was, he thought we had something to do with it. So he sends his plaza boss in Monterrey at the time, a guy named Sigifredo Najera Talamantes, alias El Canicón, or Big Marble, right? So he was a plaza boss in Monterrey, and he says, I want you to go and send them a message to the U.S. consulate, to the DEA and FBI and all those folks. So he gets the bright idea of getting a couple of underlings and getting a couple of grenades going to our office and throwing them at the U.S. consulate. A grenade detonated and blew out, you know, the glass in the front of the U.S. consulate, the entrance, and did some damage, not widespread damage, but, you know, it was enough. And they also shot up the facade of the consulate, you know, several times. And they threw another grenade and it didn't detonate. And luckily we found it. And luckily we had an ATF guy at the time who was a good friend of mine, and we were able to retrieve that and disarm it and everything. So that was the start of the war between, you know, I would say DEA and the U.S. government against the Zetas. It's like the gloves were off, man. It's okay, you're going to do this. You're going to do this. You just made a mistake.
Absolutely. You know,
just like Caro Quintero and just like Osiel, now these guys took the fight directly to us in our hometown, in Monterrey. And so we're not gonna stand by with our arms crossed and just let this get, you know, go on without some retaliation. Right.
The problem was it was going to take time, though, and the fighting and infighting continued. The murders happened. Monterrey turns into a war zone. All these places turn into war zones. I mean, I guess I'll ask you, I mean, do you have an estimate as to how many people died at the hands of people like Trevino? Do you have an estimate as?
Well, it's several thousand. I mean, I used to have in my notes. I used to have the exact statistics, but I don't have it right now. But it's in the several thousand. Yeah. So anyway, so to continue with my story about El Canicón, after this incident happened, maybe 3 days after the incident, we're lucky because we had already been doing our homework and finding and doing intel work on El Canicón and some of his cohorts. And so we had several locations that we knew that he liked to stay at. So we already had about three locations. We said, well, he likes to stay here and here and here. And he especially likes this one area where he likes to stay overnight. So 3 days after the incident, we made the decision to do an operation to try and apprehend him. And, you know, at the time we had to Monterrey assigned two guys from the federal police that were part of our special investigative unit. There's only two guys, man. They can't do anything. They can't do anything on their own. So one of our guys took the initiative and called the special forces of the federal police. They're called GOPES, Grupo de Operaciones Especiales, Special Operations Group for the federal police. And they sent down a team of, I don't know, maybe 30 guys. And so because we had done our homework, because we already had a lot of intelligence on the Canicón, we didn't have to scramble that much to plan an operation because we already knew where he was staying, where he liked to stay. So 3 days later, we go to the number one place that he liked to stay at. And it happened to be a warehouse in downtown Monterrey. And we see it's like something incredible amount of marijuana, 18,000 pounds, 9 tons.
Wow.
Several grenades, like, I don't know, 36 grenades and lots of firearms and ammunition and just all sorts of contraband and stuff like that. So, but we missed him. We didn't, he wasn't there. We had just missed him. He had left maybe 5 minutes earlier. But we were able to find out that he was staying at the location number two. So the federal police go over there along with, at this time, the army joins in, the Mexican army. And with the Mexican army and the federal police and our SIU unit, they go to location number two. It was a house in this nice area in the suburb of Monterrey. And they go. And you know, it's hard to do an operation in Monterrey because it's just a lot of people everywhere. It's just, you know, the houses are really close together. Mm-hmm. So as the team was getting closer to the house, they saw him coming. So they scramble. Canicón gets into an armored vehicle in the garage. And right as our team was going to enter the house, hit the house, he blows through the garage door, just tears it down with the armored vehicle and screams away, driving out, you know, tires screeching and everything, and a shootout ensues. And, you know, he was able to get away. But once we got inside the house, you know, there was blood all over the place. So somebody got hit. You know, I don't know who it was, but somebody got hit, but they took him. And so he takes off and he goes down the main drag of Monterrey, which is called Constitución. That's where our consulate was located. So he's going down Constitución. We had just come back. Me and my team had just come back from the seizure of the marijuana. And my boss happens to be inside the consulate, and I'm explaining what happened. And all of a sudden, you hear this gunfire. Boom, 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 boom. And it was Canicón shooting at the consulate again. And, you know, everybody panics. The alarm goes off. The duck and cover drill alarm goes off. And just chaos going inside the consulate. And we're afraid that he's going to actually come in and try to attack us.
Right.
So we get our weapons and we line up outside at the front entrance in case they try to come in and take action on us. And all of us, you know, ICE, FBI, DEA, ATF, we're all armed and we're ready to protect the U.S. consulate in case they try to, you know, enter. And it was a very tense moment, man. You know, I was at the front door and my FBI counterpart is right next to me. And this guy comes up to the front and he's got his hands in his pocket. He's wearing a jacket because it's kind of cold. And I have the AR-15 and I'm pointing it right at him. And my FBI friend is yelling at him to take his hands out of his pockets. Show us your hands. And he wouldn't do it. And just for a moment, I thought I was going to have to take this guy out, man. You know, and fortunately, it didn't happen. He pulled his hands out and he said, I just want information on a visa. It's like, dude, right now it's not
long time, man.
So, but that was very tense, man. I mean, I can't say enough about how tense it was. And that whole incident, I'm describing it in my book, which I'm almost finished with. And I'm reliving that whole time, you know. And so it was very tense. And that was the beginning of the end for the SETAs down there. Because, again, they came after us. And, you know, we're not going to stand around, just let it go, you know. So,
and you were able to piece together through the grenade by the raid, you were able to almost piece it together. That was the same serial number, if you will, of the grenade used. So that was kind of helpful, right?
Yeah, we got in an explosive expert from Mexico City come down, and the ATF guy whose specialty is explosives. And he came down, and the grenades that we seized at the warehouse, well, all the serial numbers were almost in sequence. And the grenades that exploded at the consulate, they were in that sequence. So it's like they sell them in lots.
Yeah.
So it came from the same lot number as the ones thrown at the consulate. So that's how we were able to tie El Canicón to the attack.
Now, so tell us about how it all ends for these people, people like that individual, Miguel Trevino, because ultimately all these folks, for the most part, are arrested. How does it all end for these guys?
Well, they either get arrested or they get killed. I mean, like I say, we started chipping away at the leadership, you know, and you know, Trevino, after Canicón it took us a year to get Tanikon, but when he, after the attack, he went into hiding. And Tarini was actually pissed at him for screwing that whole thing up. So he kind of sent him into hiding, and he went to Saltillo, Coahuila. But then there was another boss that came in, and we took him out. And then everyone that they sent, we were taking them out, you know. Yep. So it got to the point where nobody wanted to come to Monterrey to be the plaza boss because yeah. they were afraid, you know, because we had, at the time, the special operations group from the federal police, the army, and we had those two little groups that we were working with, but then they broke up. They disbanded. You know, once you do a good job, they're going to promote you and send you to different places. So that's what happened. So there was one time where we didn't have anybody to work with until we made contact with the Mexican Marines, CEMAR. And this was in 2009, and once we started using them, I mean, it just changed the whole ball game down there, man, because these guys, they do not mess around. No. I mean, we give them a target and they're going to be within 24 hours, they're going to be hitting that door, you know,
Right.
And these guys were trained by the Navy SEALs and stuff like that. So these guys do not mess. I had the pleasure of working with them, you know, on several operations. And once that started happening, I mean, it was, man, it was just a matter of time before, you know, we knew that we were going to accomplish our goal. So like I say, you know, every little plaza boss that was coming in and we were taking them out with either the Marines or the Army, eventually it became exclusively the Marines. But, you know, that's how we were able to accomplish it. And the Marines actually were the ones that did the operation on Lascano. And they were the ones that actually took him out.
Right.
You know, he was actually playing a softball game in Saltillo, Coahuila, somewhere in the area. And they had the intelligence, and they went in, they found him, and they took him out. And after that, Trevino became exclusively in charge. But Trevino had everybody after him. You know, he had the Marines, he had the Army, he had the Federal Police, he had Chapo, he had La Barbie. Everybody's after this guy. And eventually it got to him, you know, it's like, you know, he felt closed in. He was sleeping in ranches on the dirt, you know, with no comforts of home or nothing. And he once told a person that we knew, he said, man, I don't have a normal life, you know. 1 minute for me is like an hour for you, you know. So every time, every little minute that I have, I appreciate it, because he says, I can't take my girlfriend to the movies. You know, I can't have a normal life, you know.
Not at all.
No, he couldn't. And that's what eventually got to him, you know.
As you said real quick, that's the interesting thing that a lot of people don't remember. Like, obviously, all these people are, you know, military, the police, they're all coming after these guys. But so are the other cartels. And by this point, you know, the Gulf cartel has kind of partnered with Sinaloa. They're going after Zed 40. I mean, I remember hearing, like, a lot of these, when they mentioned on these videos, like, you're always hearing Z40. You know, we're coming after you. You're next, you know. You almost think about it, you know, with the amount of money he was making. I mean, he was a very rich man. You know, you almost wonder, like, is it all worth? You know, it's not worth it in the end. I mean, as you said, he's sleeping on dirt floors and he's constantly having to move. It's, you almost get to a point where it's too much, right? You know, and there's no end.
I guess. Yeah, he really just basically had no life, man. You know, it's just, but when things started heating up like that, you know, the wall started closing in on him, and really had nowhere to run. Eventually, we're going to catch him. And eventually, Semar did catch him.
One question I want to ask before you bring that up. You know, we see in like different criminal circles, like, informants are very, you know, they're everywhere now. Were any of these guys, as far as, you know, you alluded to, you want to get the guys and then it goes up to the next guy. Were some of these plaza people, did any of them cooperate? Consider cooperating? Is that something that even for them is that kind of outlawed? No one's doing that.
They didn't do it because they were so terrified of Trevino, because sure. Whether you're in on the inside or outside, he's going to get to you, you know. Yeah. So they never did, but we were able to get intelligence by other means. For instance, if we arrested a guy that was the plaza boss, well, we got their phones and we got contact numbers that we didn't have before, and we used that to further develop intelligence, right? So, I mean, stuff like that we used that we didn't really need their cooperation. So
the sad thing was, and I've heard this, and I'm sure you can mention it, like he would, you would do stuff like that, find people's phones, and he would almost take it out on the entire city, wouldn't he? He would go in and just eliminate people because of his, I guess he thought they were being disloyal to him. Allende, places like that, you know about that, right? He was doing stuff like that, wasn't he?
Right, he did. I mean, that's what's said. I mean, as far as the Allende incident, at the time, you know, I'm not really familiar with the details of what happened because that happened around the same time that our ICE agent Jaime Zapata was killed down in San Luis Potosí. Right. So at the time, every federal agency in Mexico, I mean, I'm talking about U.S. federal agencies, were focused on Jaime Zapata and to find the people responsible for that.
Right.
So when the Allende incident happened, it's like, wow, we just right on. We don't have time. We're focusing on Jaime's killers.
Right.
And you know, I've said this before in other interviews. I mean, it's unfortunate, but that was what our focus was at the time. We had a U.S. agent killed.
Yeah.
So that's going to be our focus, man. So
for sure.
And that's why Allende, I hate to say it, but it became, an afterthought at the time. You know, and eventually, we're able to kind of piece together what happened. So.
So tell us how it all ends for Trevino. You mentioned the Marines and Sema. They figure out where this guy is. And from what I know, there was not one shot fired. Was that surprising to you?
Surprising. It was surprising because we all thought that he was going to go down in a blaze of glory, man, you know. But he was just tired. He was just tired of running. Mm-hmm. And he pretty much gave up. You know, he said he was tired, you know. And he was riding in a pickup truck with a couple other guys, and the Marines put down a Black Hawk helicopter right in front of the pickup truck and told him to get out, you know, and he got out and he complied, but not before trying to bribe him. He said, I have a duffel bag with $1 million there in the truck. It's yours if you let me go. And they said, nope, just come on with us and we'll happily take those $1 million also and seize it. You know,
they were going to take it anyway. So.
Oh yeah, you know. So anyway, that was his end. And for some reason, after he got arrested, they didn't handcuff him. You know, before they paraded him in front of the media.
Yeah, I noticed that. That's something I was going to ask you about. We see him being paraded, and he's just walking like a regular guy. And I guess they're figuring he's not going to do anything. I guess my ask to you is, with people like him, you know, he had a big family, you know, till today. I mean, you look at his brother, Omar, he would then take over. He gets arrested. You look at currently Cartel del Noreste, which is kind of the offshoot of Los Zetas. They're still around. The Trevino name's still out there. It's probable that at one point Miguel Trevino Morales will get out of prison. He didn't get a life sentence. He wasn't extradited. Cardenas, he will get out in several years. Does that keep you up at night, like just as an law enforcement agent, that those individuals are back on the street? Because you know better than me, they're not going to go in to become mechanics or doctors. You know, that's all they know.
Right. Well, right now, Trevino, we're working on his extradition, and he's been fighting it. He's got the best lawyers, you know, they're fighting the extradition request. He actually threatened the judges in Mexico and said, if you grant this extradition, I'm going to make sure that all your families get wiped out. So he's still using those tactics from within prison to try to avoid extradition because he knows if he comes over here, you know, he's not getting out. He's never going back, you know, but we're still working on that. When I say we, I'm still talking like I'm still on the job, but my colleagues are working on that extradition. And
do you think they'll get it?
I hope so. I believe they will, you know. I mean, he's indicted in New York, in D.C., in Houston. He's got indictments all over the U.S. So,
do you think at this point he's probably the most dangerous individual as far as high-value targets that the U.S. needs to get at this point?
Well, right now, I think the most dangerous individual is El Mencho. Cartel de Jalisco.
CJ.
But definitely Trevino is right up there, man. I mean, you know, he's one of the top most dangerous individuals on the planet.
Yeah. You talked about Chiaro Quintero at the beginning. He's a very old man at this point. was arrested, you know, several months ago, finally. You know, obviously, I think it was crazy that he was ever let out to begin with. I guess, what was the DA's thought on that? I mean, I know Barack Obama, the president at the time, was very unhappy. And he got out really on a technicality. It's got to, I think, I'm sure, feel pretty good that at some point it's likely that he will be extradited and he'll have to pay for his crimes finally, right?
Well, that's hope, you know, and I hope he doesn't die in prison before that happens. You know?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of folks out there on Twitter that say, oh, he's already paid his time. Well, he paid his time in Mexico. He didn't pay it over here. So right. that's where he's wanted. So, I mean, he needs to pay for what he did over here in the United States. So, I mean, that's my, you know, so.
And incredible. Incredible stuff by you, really. I mean, really great service. I mean, I guess looking back on your career, you retired in 2015. You know, you've been retired for several years now. You know, I want to talk about your book, which I will gladly buy. And I know a lot of people that listen to this will too, with stories like this. I guess there are two questions. Do you miss that job? Number two, how did you, and I know you were on Scott Bernstein's podcast. He's a friend of the show. He kind of asked you a great question, you know, how did you deal with all this on a day-to-day basis? You know, this isn't like, you know, I know in my own life, like I get stressed out occasionally. I couldn't imagine, you know, doing what you do for a living and then going home and just having a regular life. Did it ever get to you? And ultimately, do you miss that ever?
Well, it sure got to me, you know, definitely, especially after the Jaime Zapata incident. I mean, after the Jaime Zapata thing, our team, me and my team, we spent many, many, many nights, sleepless nights. I mean, maybe running on 2-3 hours of sleep every day until we were able to accomplish our goal, which was to find the people responsible for his murder. And after that, you know, I was done, man. I mean, I was mentally smoked. You know, I had to come home for a couple of weeks vacation, and you know, and that's how you kind of deal with it. You know, at the time I was staying in Monterrey by myself because it got too dangerous, and my family came home because mm-hmm. they there was just no way that they could be over there. And it, not only my family, but everybody in the consulate, the Monterrey consulate became a adults only post, and every person with kids had to find a way to get the kids back to the United States. If you wanted to stay, you could stay, but if not, you were going to have to leave. So, and I decided to stay, and the wife and kids were here. So I didn't have the luxury of going home and you know, having a home cooked dinner or nothing. So what I would do is take vacation and come back to the States and spend time with the family. And that's how I was able to deal with it, really, you know, come and see the family over here and just get my mind off of it for a little while, mm-hmm. you know, but even then when I would come down here, you know, you never let your guard down because we're right across the border, man. You just never know.
And I think, you know, and I don't really get political, but I think one of the concerns at this point is it's not exactly difficult to find your way into America at this point. I want to ask you, and then I want to talk about your book. Anytime I speak to someone in law enforcement, I try to ask them this question. And you said one thing that I'm sure people will resonate with, where you arrested so many people, you know, the DEA arrested so many people, you know, big people, Cardenas and Chapo and all these people. And I think one thing we can all agree on, the drug war is as worse as ever, as it's ever been. And you know, whether it's a corner boy or a top level boss, someone just gets right into the position and they're arguably the strongest criminal organizations on the planet. Do you think the drug wars worked? And if so, do you look back and say, you know, I did what I had to do. I served my country. But do you ever look at it and say, maybe we're just not doing this correctly? Do you think about that ever?
Well, the responsibility just doesn't lie with U.S. law enforcement. You know, I mean, everybody has to do their part. I mean,
absolutely.
In Mexico, there's no accountability. I mean, 98% of the violent crimes in Mexico go unsolved. So until there's accountability over there in other countries, man, this is never going to stop, you know. And the Mexican government, if they really wanted to, they could take out a big chunk of this problem, you know. But
they just don't want to.
They don't want to. They're in cahoots with the traffickers.
And you're talking about even the highest levels of government, really, which is really disturbing. Do you think in your life, in your lifetime, my lifetime, do you ever think we'll see, you know, I've said publicly, I would never willingly go to Mexico, me personally. I just don't find it appealing whatsoever. Do you think ever Mexico will be a place that's not known for ruthless drug cartels and violence? Do you think it'll ever be the old Mexico ever again?
Well, until the Mexican government does something about this just rampant crime and and impunity by the criminals. I mean, they do whatever they want. They know they're not going to get caught, you know? So until something changes in that mentality, I don't think we'll ever see it, you know? So
yeah,
I hope so, because Mexico is a beautiful country. I've seen some really nice places over there. The Pacific coast down in Mexico is beautiful, yeah, you know?
Sure.
But until that happens, you know, I don't think we'll ever see it.
Yeah, it's a shame. And you know, the people in the end that falter most are just regular people. You know, the people that, you know, are just owning a business. You know, really people right. like, you know, your grandparents or descendants of yours and neighbors of yours. It's really shameful. And, you know, then again, it's almost seeped into other places as well. I want to talk about your book, and then we'll let you go. You're writing a book completely on your own, right?
That's correct.
You're just kind of typing it up and telling your life story about your time in the Drug Enforcement Agency. When do you expect it out? You know, tell us more about the title. I know I'm going to buy it. I love that sort of thing.
Yeah, the title is called Reign of Terror, and it talks about my time in Monterrey, specifically in Monterrey. Not my entire career, just my time in Monterrey and this struggle with the CEPA. So, and it's broken up into several chapters. Each chapter stands on its own and tells a story. I tell the story about El Canicón and several other plaza bosses that we were able to take down there, and the operations we conducted against them and some specifics. Not getting into much detail about how we were able to get the intelligence, but that's what it's about. And it talks about Treviño and his people and how they just terrorized not only Monterrey or Nuevo León, but the entire country, you know. So that's what my book is about.
Do you have an ETA on when you'll have it out?
Well, I'm hoping to finish it soon and send it into editing. So hopefully it'll be a couple of months afterwards.
What we'll have to do is we'll have to make sure we speak to you again and get you some people to know what's out there. I'm looking forward to it. One final question I just have to ask. We've heard about El Mencho, you know. He's probably the most recognizable guy. Do you think El Mencho is alive still? That's been a big
thing. I think he is, but I think he's barely hanging on. I mean, I've heard that his condition has worsened. He's got a diabetes. I think he's on dialysis, and I think his condition is worsening. And you know, the last I heard is that he's barely hanging on.
There was a guy from CSRL, Elmaro, I believe. He made a comment at one point that he basically proved that in his case that he died. I guess they found that the handwriting's completely different, but I guess we'll have to see. You know, he is an elusive individual and a very accomplished dude. So I guess we'll have to wait and see. But Leonardo Silva, I got to tell you, this is one of my favorite interviews I ever did. Just fascinating look into the world of law enforcement. You never answered. Do you miss that world? Tell me. You do, don't you?
Yeah, there's times where I do. You know, there's times where I do. But then I start thinking about all the red tape and stuff. I'll tell you a little quote that, you know, one of my favorite coaches is Bill Parcells. And they asked him one time, do you miss the NFL? He says, well, you know, I miss the circus. I don't miss the clowns, you know.
Sure. That's a great quote to use, because it's very meaningful to your life, right? You know, you can only do so much, and you could put your world into it, and in the end someone above you is above your pay grade. Real quick, last question, I promise. That arrest you made with El Puma, did any of your did any of the people above you make any comments about it being one of the craziest arrests ever? Because it has to be one of the wildest stories.
Sure, my boss. I mean, I had my immediate supervisor here in McAllen, but his boss in Houston, who was the boss of the whole division, he was fascinated by it, you know. Yeah. And every time he came down to visit us down here, he wanted me to tell the story over and over again. And yeah, man, they loved it. I mean, I got calls from headquarters and you know, Washington, D.C. and stuff, congratulating me on that arrest.
Well, I'll tell you what. The DEA should give your wife some reward. She should get some of the reward for the seizure and the incarceration. But Leonardo Silva, fascinating. We're definitely going to get you on. I'm looking forward to the book, Reign of Terror. I will definitely purchase it. I'm sure a lot of our people will as well. I'm going to put your Twitter in the description. Let's try to get you back on soon. Maybe we'll do some other stuff and try to promote the book a little bit. I appreciate you coming on today. I know we had some tech issues, but you're here. It was great. And I thank you for coming on.
It was my pleasure, man. Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Big money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning architectural shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in store and on menards.com, and check out more of our great deals going on now.
Save